Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I'm with Brad again. How you doing?
I'm awesome, man. How you been, Dennis?
Not too bad, not too bad. And since thankfully it wasn't that long ago that you were just on, so I think we can kind of skip the introduction and jump straight into the topic of fentanyl. And luckily, I know that you've got a lot of experience pushing fentanyl. I've read the word fentanyl, so I think I'm fairly prepared for it. But so far, my unit hasn't given it to me yet. So I guess it seems like lately, IV fentanyl has been something that's been starting to get pushed out more and more lately. So I guess, why is it even useful? I have ketamine and I can spice it up with Versed. Why do I even need fentanyl?
Well, I think the biggest thing to start off with then is to just look at the history of fentanyl just a little bit, which will help describe like why it's such an important drug. And again, you know, like we talked about last time, it is a really good tool to put into your toolbox as long as you understand what it's good for, how to use it, and the situations that make the most sense to use it. So fentanyl was developed actually over in Belgium in the 1950s by Dr. Janssen of, you know, back then Janssen Pharmaceuticals was just starting up. And their whole goal was to create a very reliable opioid as, you know, in response to morphine and Demerol of the time. They wanted something that was much more predictable without as many of the side effects, one of those being the histamine release of the other ones, and that was incredibly titratable. So if I was going to create, and this goes with any drug, if I was going to create the most titratable drug that I could, what would I want that drug to look like? Well, I would want it to be very specific for whatever it is that I'm trying to do. And in this case, treat pain. So very specific to the mu receptors. I would want the drug to have the absolute fastest onset time, because onset being I give the drug, and we're talking IV, I give the drug, and once I give the drug, the person starts, you start to see the effect of the drug. So I want that to be very fast to know that it's working quickly. I would want the peak of the drug to be incredibly fast. So if I give, let's say, 50 micrograms of fentanyl, the entire 50 micrograms is working at that point. And I want to know that quickly so that I need to know if I need to give more. The other part of that is I would want a drug that goes away very fast. So if I overdid it, it would wear off quickly. And then I would know like, okay, you know, it's going to start to go away, and then I can decide when to redose the drug. So that was basically their goal, was to create, and it's a totally synthetic opioid created in the lab that has a rapid onset, especially compared to Demerol and morphine. That onset time typically was in 60 seconds to 2 minutes at the most. It peaks in less than 5 minutes, normally somewhere in the 3 to 5 minute range. And compared to the other opioids of the time, it goes away quickly, meaning that normally fentanyl, when you're giving it IV, is gone in about an hour. And most people will tell you, like in the anesthesia world, like you can almost set an egg timer by it. You know, when you're dosing your fentanyl, you know, 45 minutes after you've given that dose, you need to be thinking about, I need to start to redose again because it's going away, you know, within that time frame. So basically, it gained FDA approval back in 1968 under a kind of a different name, paired up with another drug. And it was marketed as something called Inovar back then, which was a sedative combination of drugs. But it really started to take off kind of more in the 80s. and into the early 90s, especially in the anesthesia world, where we were looking at high narcotic type surgeries, those being cardiac type surgeries, because fentanyl is very cardiovascular stable, which is another really great component of it, even into the realm of things like trauma that, you know, we're going to deal with a lot of times. So that was where it started to really take off and start to have, you know, its greatest effect, and people starting to understand really what it was great for, its predictability, its potency. It's 100 times more potent than morphine is. And so therefore, you're dealing in microgram dosages of it. The other nice thing about fentanyl is how it's packaged. One of the things you worry about with morphine a lot of times is, because it's such an old drug, is that it comes in all these different concentrations. You know, it shows up and it's 1 milligram per cc, it's 10 milligrams per cc, it's 15 milligrams per cc. Fentanyl, whether it's a jug or whether it's a little bitty ampule, is going to come to you as 50 micrograms per cc. And that's great, because that's very predictable for the guys that are having to learn about it and how do I dose this. The other nice thing about that is a typical dose, and we're talking adults now, is 50 micrograms, 1 cc of fentanyl, and we're talking IV, because that compares to 5 milligrams of morphine. So whenever you're trying to... you know, I always say, like, when you're under a lot of stress, your brain runs home to mama. If morphine's your run home to mama, you know, you've known that forever. Well, if I'm going to give somebody 5 milligrams of morphine, what would that translate into a fentanyl dose? That's 50 micrograms of fentanyl, which is 1 cc. And so therefore, it makes things easy math-wise. I think you and I talked about, I grew up in Arkansas. No one likes to do math in public, you know, that kind of deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of the background of most of it. With its positive attributes of it, again, like I said, it's very potent. You don't have the histamine release that you see with morphine, so it's becomes more cardiovascular stable. On the other side of the house with the side effects, well, those are very similar to most of the opioids that are out there, minus the histamine thing. You're going to see CNS depression. You're going to see respiratory depression. You're going to see meiosis, nausea and vomiting, especially if you're moving casualties. We'll talk a little bit about that with lollipops too, all considerations that you're going to have. I think the biggest one of the side effects, and you can tell me from your side of the house as well, that I have seen, and this goes into the resistance of using fentanyl, is the respiratory depression, because it can be, it's more potent respiratory depressant than morphine is. So a lot of times when I was teaching this, when I was still active duty and getting the guys more comfortable with it, that was one of the biggest pushbacks, you know, was got so much respiratory depression. It does, but it's in relation to everything else, you know. And the other one that people like to toss out there, and this is really more from a lack of understanding, is I'll get the, well, what about this wooden chest syndrome, you know, that pops up, or it's mahogany chest syndrome, which is basically... it will seize up the respiratory muscles, the diaphragm, and around the ribs. And so a lot of times people are like, well, that's just, you know, I've read about this and that's just way too dangerous. The reality of that is, in the dosages that we're talking about, I've never, ever seen it. I'm not going to say it's never happened. But where you see that is in these very high dosages that we use to, put patients under general anesthesia with just fentanyl. So we're talking 20, 30, 40 cc's of fentanyl, which is a whopping dose compared to the 1 cc that we're talking about. So, yeah.
Yeah, kind of in a nutshell. That chest wall rigidity symptom there. I've only really heard about it in pediatrics. I'm sure that it exists out there. There are a lot of childlike adults, but I haven't heard of it in adults. You've used it way more than me, I'm sure, but
In cardiac surgery, you can see it because you're pushing so much of it all, and I'm talking all at once, you know. But the other thing about cardiac surgery is you're also following it up with a neuromuscular blocker, such as rocuronium, at the same time. And so even then you don't see it because just as maybe you're getting the chest rigidity starting to kick in, the rocuronium is basically blocking all the neuromuscular junctions and they relax and it's not a problem anyway. So, but I do like to point that out to people because that's one of the first things people used to always, when I was getting the guys, you know, in the beginning, starting to use it, that was one of the big pushbacks from, you know, brigade surgeons and battalion surgeons, you know, and the more you talk to them, it was really a matter of fact that they really hadn't used fentanyl. You know, I mean, they were comfortable with morphine, but, you know, unless they came from a background in medicine where they had done a lot of sedations and they just weren't using it as much either. And so it was more just an education process for everyone involved to be able to say, you know, here's really what we're looking at, you know, when it comes to these things. So,
And I think at least just in my experience, limited as it is, usually you'll get like the respiratory depression, potentially respiratory failure. You push a big dose of it because of the speed that you're pushing it. I find that if I'm patient with it and I'm giving a normal dose, I really don't have as much of that respiratory depression. It's more just, I would say, relaxation.
Yeah, and I think you know, we discussed it on the last podcast, you know, titrate to effect, right?
Yep. I love that word.
but it is titrate to what effect, like we talked about last time, in respiratory rate in the field. And that's a big part of this too, is getting people to understand that what we are really talking about here on these podcasts is out there in the field, in the dirt. Yep. Not at a cache. We're out there, you know, solo working out of a bag. Is that what markers can I use, you know, when I'm given an opioid? And respiratory rate is really one of the very best markers that we can use. And so one of the things that I'm looking for is, again, you know, if I'm going to give someone, if they're breathing 8 times a minute, they probably don't need anything at all. You know, they're probably doing okay. If they're breathing 20, 24 times a minute and I'm going to give them something, then with fentanyl, the starting dose typically is just 50 micrograms, 1 cc. Now, that's caveated by the fact of I'm not worried about, you know, there's massive hypotension going on. They've been bleeding, you know, those kinds of things. Then I'm going to decrease my dose to 25 micrograms, which is a half cc, which again makes things very easy. The beauty of using fentanyl, and what I've tried to get people to understand, is that because it's working very quickly, I know within a few minutes if I actually do need to give more. The problem people always run into at times with morphine or, you know, things like Demerol or Dilaudid is they have somebody screaming and yelling in pain. They give them that initial dose and they just don't let it, you know, it takes 15 minutes to peak, you know, 15, 20 minutes. When someone's screaming in pain at you, typically it's really hard to wait, you know, that long. And so they redose again. And then all that starts to build up and starts to peak. And then you get a massive respiratory depression. You're like, what's going on? Well, everything's happening once. With fentanyl, I'm only waiting a couple of minutes. I'm looking at the respiratory rate. If they're still breathing 20 times a minute, I'm going to give them 50 micrograms more, you know? And within a few minutes, being able to, again, it's a much more titratable drug that I can judge where that respiratory rate is. And I'm fairly confident that the pain level is going to be back down to where I need it to be, and then I'm going to leave it alone. You know, yeah. The other nice thing about fentanyl is it is really great when we talk about the sedation side of the house. One thing is, you know, we're talking about pain control, but when we get into sedation, meaning procedure type stuff, is really where this started out. Because we were working on different types of procedure that were going to cause levels of pain that the current TTPs weren't going to cover for the guys. The great thing about fentanyl was it was potent enough to make things easy during sedation procedure, but then it was going to wear off quick enough to where once that procedure was done, I could still continue with fentanyl if I needed to. That might be all that I had. But once that procedure was done and the pain level was back under control, then I could switch to a longer term narcotic, meaning, you know, dilaudid or morphine. And then I could save my fentanyl if I had to do another procedure that way. That was part of the thinking behind the other side of the house as well. So anyway,
Food for thought. You know, even when you're doing just straight up pain control, I mean, you're still getting some kind of sedative effect, or they just kind of chill out a lot more than, you know, your ketamine tends to get people a little more excited.
Correct. The one thing I also will say, pushback wise at times that you see is when you combine any opioid with any benzodiazepine, commonly we're gonna be talking about Versed. Valium's still out there, but man, we're talking about Versed. Is you can have a synergistic effect, meaning, you know, 1 + 1 no longer equals 2; it may equal 3, 4, or 5 of an effect. One of those being respiratory depression, if you're combining those drugs. So if I have started, let's say, and I've given someone 2 milligrams of Versed, and then I'm dosing my fentanyl, I'm still going to start at my 50 microgram dose, but respiratory depression is even more on my mind, you know, to see what kind of effect it's going to have on the respiratory rate. Doesn't mean I'm really going to change that much. It just means like I may not have to give as much just based on the fact that they get a synergistic effect from the Versed as well, which kind of goes back to what you were talking about with ketamine. Ketamine's amazing. We all know that it's amazing, but there are times whenever you may not be able to use ketamine. It may not be, you may not have any left, you know, multiple times we went through episodes where you were out, you know, and it's like, what's in the bag? You know, again, back to the tool chest. What do I have in here that I can make sense to use? I know how to use it, and it's incredibly effective, you know, as well. So, yeah, again, early on, it was very common to use a 2 milligram Versed dose followed by 50 micrograms of fentanyl and then titrate in bumps of ketamine to do a procedure. It's an incredibly effective way to do it. And you don't use up as much as your ketamine that way. You don't use as much as your Versed, and you don't use as much as your fentanyl. So it's a way to stretch medications in a way as well to do a procedure. We're talking like chest tubes, crikes, setting major fractures, those kinds of things.
I just got a question about your strategy. You're talking about Versed, then fentanyl, and then if you need to, ketamine. Usually when I do my own narcotics, or if I'm trying to explain it to others, I'll tell them, hey, if your plan is going to be fentanyl and Versed, let's, you know, keep it simple. Mm-hmm. Keep going with the fentanyl until you get what you want out of it as far as pain control. And then if you need to after that, then you can feather in some Versed and, you won't be masking anything with your sedative. You'll know exactly where you are. Mm-hmm. But I hear it fairly commonly, you know, we'll push Versed first and we'll let that start to cook. And then we'll add an analgesic on top of it because we know it's pretty rapid. Am I doing it wrong? Or?
No. And I think really you're not doing it wrong because it's based on what you're trying to achieve. And I think really what we're talking about is two different avenues of approach for kind of like a different situation. Sure. One avenue is I'm trying to treat pain. There's something wrong, femur fracture, those kinds of things. It's totally okay to not have to use Versed at all with somebody like that, because really I always say you got to use the right drug for the right problem. Well, I'm trying to treat pain. That says opioid. Okay. Yeah. So yes, I can go straight fentanyl. It's an incredible drug, 50 microgram bumps until I get the respiratory rate down, let's say in that 8 to 12 to 16 range. Their pain is under control. That's all I need at that point. I'm good. If for some reason they were starting to get very agitated, nervous for, you're having to move them or things happen. Yes, then Versed's going to work on the agitation and that side of the house. So that's kind of one problem. But the other side of the house is the sedation protocol side of the house, whereas I need to do something for this. And let's go back to the fracture. Let's say I had a major long bone fracture. I'm going to have to set this thing, get it into a splint, into a traction splint, kind of going down that road. Now I know that up front, I am going to start with the Versed. I'm going to go ahead and get the 2 milligrams on board to start. Then once that's cooking, now I'm going to go ahead and dose in my 50 micrograms of fentanyl to start. And then if I'm going to use ketamine, I'm going to stop with the fentanyl and then go to the ketamine. If I'm going to continue with the fentanyl, then I'm just going to continue with the fentanyl at that point. Okay. The other nice thing about Versed and fentanyl is that they have the same drug profile. And why that, and what I mean by that is their onset times are the same, their peaks are the same, and then their duration is basically the same. So one reason, it's no fluke that whenever you talk about sedation that you use Versed and fentanyl, it's because they have the same profile. Okay. You know, that's why people don't anymore. You don't talk about using Versed and morphine because they're nowhere close to each other as their onset times and peaks and durations. So anytime you can marry up, we're back to the sedation side of the house. Anytime you can marry up drugs that have very similar profiles, it makes things much easier to predict what's going to happen and when you may need to give more and those types of things. And again, because they work so fast, it allows you to work faster. It allows you to work quicker is a way to look at that. So, yeah, again, not wrong with what you're saying. It's just different problem coming at it at kind of a different angle. So,
okay. Yeah. Too easy. We just got done talking about femur fractures, and that's a great patient for fentanyl. What other types of patients, how about this? What kind of patient would you not want to use fentanyl on?
Well, I guess the age old one is anyone who has a fentanyl allergy.
Okay.
I've never seen it. I guess it's in the literature. I swear to you though, I've never seen it. I know someone out there somebody's definitely got a fentanyl allergic. Allergy. But it's almost like Dumb and Dumber. You're telling me there's a chance. Yeah. I've never, ever seen that. Not saying it's not out there. But really, honestly, other than that, and I don't want to, like I told you before, I don't like removing tools out of the toolbox, but I really wish people would start mentally thinking more about putting fentanyl in the toolbox and shoving the morphine to the back of the toolbox. Yeah. Not that it doesn't have uses, or even the Dilaudid, push it to the back, because fentanyl is just so much better, so much more predictable. As a drug, and has so many better attributes to the drug. The only problem you see, I think, right now is because it's all over the news is the fentanyl crisis.
Right.
So it's oddly, it's gotten a bad rap kind of for all the wrong reasons, you know, almost right. like ketamine got a bad rap back in the day, you know, that kind of a deal. But honestly, in trauma, it is the go-to opioid in trauma.
Okay.
You know, and that's really what we're talking about, you know, yeah. for the most part. But if I am going to give anyone that's in any kind of a trauma scenario an opioid, trust me, it's going to be fentanyl. It is not going to be morphine, especially because of the histamine release. It's not going to be dilaudid. Again, same reasons. It's going to be fentanyl. And I got to tell you, you know, back in, you know, 80s, 90s, if you went into any level one trauma center, you know, going into surgery and someone that was severely hypotensive, if they got anything, it was what we used to call scope and ope, mm-hmm. meaning scopolamine up front just to scramble their brain a little bit, and an opioid, and that opioid was fentanyl, and that was it. Yeah. You know, mainly going back to the cardiovascular stability of the drug. Now, fentanyl is very potent as far as blocking, you know, as far as the systemic release, and basically, you know, with blood pressure and things along those lines, it will blunt, you know, the effect. So can you get hypotension from fentanyl? You know, absolutely you can, you know, because, but compared to the other drugs, you know, it's going to have much less of an effect. So,
yeah. And I imagine just relieving pain alone can kind of blunt that sympathetic drive.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, in fact, back to the cardiac surgeries, the reason that you're using it is because you actually are trying to block the sympathetic drive so the patient doesn't get tachycardic whenever you're doing things like intubating or surgical incision and those kinds of things, because, you know, like they teach you in school, tachycardia is the devil in anyone who has a bad heart. You're right.
Right.
So you're literally using the fentanyl as the blockade of the sympathetic. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. For sure. Now, we've been talking about IV, and mm-hmm. I suppose you can also do it IM as well. It works.
Yeah, it works, but people just don't do it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's frowned upon.
Well, yeah. You know, you got to do what you got to do. But yeah, it's just such a great IV drug. Use an IV, right?
Right. Now, we're also, even way back when I was running around the hills there, we had fentanyl lollipops. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a waste of time to actually make them. I don't know why they make them, because, you know, I give it to a guy and nothing happens, right? So he may, and if it, anything does happen, he got sick, you know? So why do we waste our time making lollipops?
Well, it's because lollipops are awesome, you know?
I mean, but like the candy ones, yeah.
Well, yeah, but... funny enough, when they first came out, they actually looked more like a lollipop. It was actually called Oracet back then. It had like a red, it kind of looked like a cherry sucker a little bit, you know, and right. the FDA wouldn't approve it outside the hospital because it looked too much like a sucker. Anyway, funny thing was they figured this out in the lab with rhesus monkeys to sedate them, because they were having trouble with the IM injections, and they wanted to do an easier way. And one of the guys decided to take a sugar cube, because monkeys love to suck on the sugar cubes. And back then they put some carfentanil on the sugar cube and gave it to the monkeys, and they sucked them right up, and they worked, and they were like, wow, we're onto something here, kind of a thing. The lollipops got FDA approved in 1998, I think it was. And again, the idea behind that lollipop was an easy route of administration. You know, kids pre-surgery, you know, was a part of that. You know, it's like, hey, you know, it's absorbed very well in the mucosa of the mouth, as long as you use it the right way. And that's part of the problem with the lollipops. The other problem, especially early on, was they came in 200 microgram, 400 microgram, 800 and 1600 microgram. And some people were getting the 200s and 400s and they were like, oh, we're not getting any effect out of these. And it, you know, for an adult, you know, kind of the normal operator size guys, it's just not enough, you know, so to speak. And eventually we settled in on the 800 microgram lollipops as kind of the go-to. And then we still had the 1600s. The thing about the lollipops is that to use it correctly, you have to basically put it in between the cheek and the gum and move it back and forth, kind of like you're brushing your gums, you know, kind of thing. I used to joke with the guys, they're like, just put this back where you put your dip, you know, put it in and then just gently move it back and forward. The other part of that was the poor man's PCA pump was, everyone knows the trick to tape the lollipop to the finger. And then once they would get enough of the fentanyl on board and start to get, you know, kind of narcotized and sleepy, they would fall out of the mouth. And then, you know, after a few minutes, they'd wake back up, they'd see it and then put it back in their mouth, which is, you know, works great. So it's using it the right way. The other thing is almost like a Tootsie Pop, you know, you'd always tell the guys, be like, hey man, put this in your mouth, cheek and gum, rub it back and forth. Whatever you do, don't bite and swallow it. And you'd always get the response, you know, you turn around and be like, screw you, doc. And they bite it. I'm hurting. And they think they're getting more of the drug by biting it and swallowing it like a Tootsie Pop. You're like, oh man, you know, so 25% of the drug is going in through the mucosa and gets into the system very quickly. Quickly by that, I mean, about 10 minutes, they're getting the drug into the system. But even then, as they're sucking on the lollipop in the saliva, they're swallowing about 75% of that drug. The problem with when you swallow it is it goes down into the stomach. And then as it absorbs in through, it goes in a first pass effect directly to the liver without getting into the systemic circulation. So you don't get any effect of it until once it goes to the liver. When it does that, the liver chews up a bunch of the drug. So you're losing that drug because the liver's already metabolizing it, which is good and it's bad. One good thing about that happens with the drug that you swallow is it actually increases the duration of the drug compared to if you were given it IV. So even though fentanyl goes away in about an hour IV, because they're swallowing some of the drug and most of it's going down into the stomach, going through the first pass effect, by the time it does all that, that part of the drug stretches out. So you'll get like 2 hour duration out of your lollipop, maybe even a little longer than that, depending on how much they process it through their stomach and through their liver. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a great way to go, as long as people are using it the right way and their expectations are what they are. Now, as far as the 800 micrograms, that seemed to be the one where people could use the 800 microgram. They were getting enough of the effect for the pain, and they tended not to vomit. Whereas when we upped it to the 1600 microgram dose, people, especially if you're moving them around, like in the back of a truck or flying in a helicopter, whatever it was, that's when they would, you know, a lot of times they'd yak. Or this, you got to remember this too, is like, let's say, because if I'm using one 800 microgram lollipop and it's not working well, a lot of times we'll give them a second one, right? Mm-hmm. Anytime I give anyone that second lollipop, I go ahead and give them Zofran if I have Zofran. Okay. Just because I know that they're going to get nauseous and they're probably going to puke, especially if I'm moving them. So I always try and tell people, like, I don't always do that with the 800s, but if I'm at an 800 and I'm getting ready to give them another one and I have Zofran, I go ahead and give them Zofran to try and offset that nausea that's going to come with that extra dose. So again, okay.
Yeah. You know, but you know, like a 4 or 8 milligrams of Zofran?
Just 4 milligrams, you know, or if you have the little tablets, sure. You know, the under the tongue tablets, give them one of those, pop that in there. it's not great for motion sickness, so it doesn't always help with that side of the house, but it will calm down some of that, that nausea from the extra narcotic coming on board. So,
okay.
Yeah. Food for thought.
Sure. Yeah. I've also noticed guys, especially when you're out and about, they're dehydrated, they're mm-hmm. stressed, so their mm-hmm. mouth is dry.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have them drink water with it or?
If it's not contraindicated to drink water for whatever they've got going on, you know, and most times if I'm giving them a lollipop, there's probably not other things going on that they couldn't have the water. Something to wet their mouth a little bit, to be able to get it going. And a lot of times just it being in there, and moving it back and forth will actually kind of increase some of the secretions to help you out as well.
Okay.
But it's getting them to move that thing back and forth. If it gets in there and they got a little bit of a dry mouth anyway, and it just sits, it will kind of like stick in one spot and they're not really absorbing it very well. Okay. That's also the other part of too, though, if they haven't pulled their dip out of their mouth, pull the dip out of their mouth before you give it to them. Cause this is, it's in the way, so to speak. So, the other good thing about taping it to their finger is so they don't swallow the damn thing.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Because they can get narcotized to the point where they're very somnolent, like you were talking about before, and a lot of times the tongue will start to slip back. And if the lollipop's in there loose, they could suck it back into the back of the throat. So that's another good reason to have it, taped to the finger. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Another route I've heard of, and we've started getting some of the patches, mm-hmm. patches at work. And I've heard that it's not uncommon, like in Ukraine or some other places, just from what I understand, they're cheaper than the lollipops. is this even worth, like, why did we go to a lollipop when we could just put a sticker on their back?
Okay. So, a couple things about that. First off, one thing we didn't say about the lollipops is they really are incredibly expensive. That's why our NATO partners, you don't see them running around with them. Now, I do know over the last few years, I think they have started to come out with a generic form of the lollipop. So hopefully the price is coming down, but, sticker shock back then it was $600 a lollipop. I mean, I didn't know that, you know what I mean? And people were like, holy smokes, So that's why, the Brits weren't running around with them or the Germans or, whoever. It's like, this is very expensive. So, back to the question with the patches, people are looking for different ways, cheaper ways to do that. But the patches were never created for something along the lines of what we're dealing with. The patches nowadays, they were approved, FDA approved back in early 90s, like around 93, 94. They actually came on the market in the 80s. And the problem was they were just slapping these people on that had no, we could call them opioid naive, meaning they're not on long-term narcotics for some reason anyway. And there was a lot of respiratory depression happening unexpected, meaning like 2 days later, somebody stops breathing type of thing. They had some deaths. So when it did come back on board, it was really meant for almost think of it as a background infusion of mm-hmm. low dose narcotic for some like cancer patients or people that are on, oral morphines or things along that line so that they're not having to take as much by mouth and they could create this background dose of it. When you look at the patches, you'll see like they're called Duragesic normally, and you'll see like 25, 50, 75, 100. That number, what it means is that's the micrograms per hour that's being absorbed through the skin is the deal. So that's how the dosage kicks in. Now, the problem with that is One is it takes a very long time for it to actually get up to its level, meaning anywhere from 12 up, you know, like 18 hours that you're going to be waiting on this thing to actually start to kick in. The temperature of the skin plays a big role in that. And so if they're very cold or they're shunting, like a lot of times that we talk about, they're shunting away into the core, and you're not getting the blood flow out to the skin, which is very common with what we're dealing with, they're not going to pick up the drug hardly at all. The really bad thing is on the flip side, though. If the skin gets very hot, and I want you to think about it like this. Let's say I've got somebody and I had decided to put a patch on them. And then I put the patch on them thinking I'm doing this guy a good thing. And then I wrap them up in an HPMK with the warmer on the inside and they start cooking on the inside of this thing, right? That causes an increased release of the drug that's not controllable. So they're going to get more of the effect of the drug than I ever expected them to actually get. You know, and even on things like, you know, there's warnings on there, like don't get in a hot bath, don't get in a sauna, don't get in, you know, all these things that are going to increase the skin temperature could cause a, you know, unknown release of the drug. In fact, back in the early 2000s, there were a couple of recalls with them because there was something wrong with the delivery, the stuff that actually is helping the drug cross over and through the skin. And they were getting abnormal amounts released through the skin that were uncontrolled. And so the FDA recalled them a couple of times as well. So it's really not, I know we're always trying to find new ways and different ways. It's just not the best way to go. The other thing I always worry about with those is like down the road, let's say I put the patch on, I almost forget about the patch being on. You know, because it's small and it's, you know, a lot of times people will put them on the back or the shoulder or somewhere, you know, and it's out of sight, out of mind almost, you know. And then let's say I'm transporting this guy over 24 hours or something like that. And this all of a sudden starts to build up, you know, kind of later in that time frame. And I get this massive amount of respiratory depression. I'm like, what is going on? You know, almost forgetting that I've got that patch on. Not only that is, always think about handing off to someone else because eventually you're passing them off, right? Yep. And let's say I've transported them to an HLZ somewhere over like an entire day. I've put the patch on, something gets lost in the sauce with the transfer report. I hand it off to a medic on the aircraft who's flying them out or somewhere else. He doesn't know that it's on there. You know, I know we all do our best to like see things like that, but it's not a very big thing, you know? Yep. And so then he's dealing with something. He doesn't know why, you know, kind of a deal. Anyway, to me, it's like there's just way better options for us than using them. The other thing I've heard people doing, I think, you know, we were talking about before is like, oh, well, I'll cut it in half. You know, anytime you damage the patch, you damage the delivery of the drug. Meaning you can increase the delivery of the drug, not necessarily decrease it. And so like if you're cutting them up, you kind of don't know what you're getting anymore, especially if you said like, oh, well, I'm going to take this 100, this Jurgic 100, and if I cut it in half, it's a 50. You don't know that. You know what I mean? And so once you start damaging those patches, it's also true that you're not really sure what you're going to get as far as the absorption out of it as well. So anyway.
Yeah. Makes sense. I mean, I like titrating up the difficulty by my bad decisions. So,
well, you know, it keeps you on your toes. So
that's right. That's how I learn. Yeah. Right.
That's right. That's right. Right.
Cool. Is there anything else you really want us to know about fentanyl?
Well, when we do talks like this, I always try and, you know, tell people, this is the starting point, you know, don't walk away from this. It's like, okay, now I've heard this, I'm a fentanyl expert. This is just the beginning, you know, to go, dig in the books and hopefully get into, you know, a first off, some kind of a clinic or hospital environment where you can watch some sedations, see fentanyl being used, see those, how people react to fentanyl. Because it really is a fantastic drug to be able to put into the toolbox, you know? But it, you know, again, like any drug, there are the things that you have to watch out for. One of those absolutely upfront is the respiratory depression. So, it's interesting though, that you can make people so comfortable on fentanyl that they will be wide awake, staring at you and not breathing, you know, because like any opioid, you're shifting that. They're in tidal CO2 in the brain, you're shifting that response curve. And so until the CO2 builds up enough of them not breathing, you know, they won't breathe. The other wild thing about it is that burning that we all get in our chest when you hold your breath too long, they don't have it because that pain is being treated. And so literally, I'll look at somebody and be like, Dennis, take in a deep breath, and they'll go, no, we didn't pause. You know what I mean? It's like, and it's like 2-3 minutes. I'm like taking a big deep breath, and as long as you tell them to do it, they'll do it, right. You know, but they don't have those, you know, those markers. And so, but, yeah, incredibly useful. Great because of the way that it's supplied, meaning like it's always in that 50 microgram concentration, which means I don't need to dilute this down. I don't need to cut it like morphine I have to do at times. It comes in that 1 cc starter dose, 0.5 cc if I'm worried about hypotension, if I'm going to give anything at all. I will say when you're ordering it, you absolutely want to try and get the vials, not the ampules, because the ampules will break in a bag, you know, if you're not careful with how you put the ampules in the bag. Now, early on, all we could do was get the ampules. We couldn't get the multi-dose vials out of them. And we would get the 5 cc ampules. And the way that I kind of fortified that was, if you go to the PX still and they got the cigars and the tubes, you know, got the little screw top on the end, it's a little metal tube. Yep. It'd take the cigar out, smoke the cigar, put a little toilet paper in the bottom of the tube, put the first ampule in butt first, put some more toilet paper in, take the other ampule and put it in nose first. So it's nose to nose in the tube, and then screw the cap back on, throw it into your aid bag. It would protect it. Yeah. And you know, so there's all kinds of ways to use the ampules. It's just, you know,
got to protect
it. Much better. Yeah. Got to protect it. So yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you, Brad. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Dennis. Anytime. Love talking with you, man.
Yeah, I love talking to you.
That's it for today's podcast. Be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Our boy is waiting there for you.